Harper Perennial and Harper Audio present Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a novel by Quentin Tarantino. Performed by Jennifer Jason Lee. This book is dedicated to my wife, Daniela, and my son, Leo. Thanks for creating a happy home from which to write in. Also, to all the actor old-timers, who told me tremendous stories about Hollywood in this period. And it's because of them that you are hearing this now. Bruce Dern, David Carradine, Burt Reynolds, Robert Blake, Michael Parks, Robert Forster, and especially Kurt Russell. Chapter 1. Call Me Marvin. The buzzer on Marvin Schwartz's desk dictaphone makes a noise. The William Morris agent's finger holds the lever down on the box.
Is this my 10:30 you're buzzing me about, Miss Himmelstein?
Yes, it is, Mr. Schwartz. His secretary's voice pipes out of the tiny speaker. Mr. Dalton is waiting outside. Marvin pushes down the lever again.
I'm ready when you are, Miss Himmelstein.
When the door to Marvin's office opens, his young secretary, Miss Himmelstein, steps in first. She's a 21-year-old woman of the hippie persuasion. She sports a white miniskirt that shows off her long tan legs and wears her long brown hair in Pocahontas-style pigtails that hang down each side of her head. The handsome 42-year-old actor, Rick Dalton, and his de rigueur glistening wet brown pompadour follow behind her. Marvin's smile grows wide as he stands up from the chair behind his desk. Miss Himmelstein tries to do the introductions, but Marvin cuts her off.
Miss Himmelstein, since I just finished watching a Rick Dalton fucking film festival, no need to introduce this man to me.
Marvin crosses the distance between them, sticking out his hand for the cowboy actor to shake.
Put her there, Rick.
Rick smiles and gives the agent's hand a big, pumping shake.
Rick Dalton, thank you very much, Mr. Schwartz, for taking the time to meet me.
Marvin corrects him.
It's Schwartz, not Schwartz.
Jesus Christ, I'm fucking this whole thing up already, Rick thinks.
God damn it to hell. I'm sorry about that, Mr. Schwartz.
As Mr. Schwartz does a final shake of the hand, he says,
Call me Marvin.
Marvin. Call me Rick.
Rick.
They let go of each other's hand.
Can Miss Himmelstein get you a tasty beverage?
Rick waves the offer away.
No, I'm fine.
Marvin insists.
Are you sure?
Nothing.
Coffee, Coke, Pepsi, Simba.
All right, Rick says. Maybe a cup of coffee.
Good.
Clapping the actor on the shoulder, Marvin turns to his young girl Friday.
Miss Himmelstein, would you be so kind as to get my friend Rick here a cup of coffee, and I'll have one myself.
The young lady nods her head in the affirmative and crosses the length of the office. As she starts to close the door behind her, Marvin yells after her.
Oh! And none of that Maxwell House rot gut they got in the break room. Go to Rex's office,
Marvin instructs.
He's always got the classiest coffee. But none of that Turkish shit, Marvin warns.
Yes, sir, Miss Himmelstein answers, then turns to Rick. How do you take your coffee, Mr. Dalton?
Rick turns to her and says, Haven't you heard?
Black is beautiful.
Marvin lets out a Glaxon-like guffaw, while Miss Himmelstein covers her mouth with her hand as she giggles.
Before his secretary can close the door behind her, Marvin yells out,
Oh, and Miss Himmelstein, short of my wife and kids dead on the highway, hold my calls. In fact, if my wife and kids are dead, well, they'll all be just as dead 30 minutes from now, so hold all my calls.
The agent gestures for the actor to sit on one of two leather sofas that face each other, a glass-top coffee table between them, and Rick makes himself comfortable.
First things first, the agent says. I send you greetings from my wife, Mary Alice Schwartz. We had a Rick Dalton double feature in our screening room last night. Wow, that's both flattering and embarrassing, Rick says. What'd you see? Film prints of Tanner and the 14 Fists of McCluskey. Well, them are two of the good ones, Rick says. McCluskey was directed by Paul Wankos. He's my favorite of all my directors. He made Gidget. I was supposed to be in that. Tommy Laughlin got my part. But then he magnanimously waves it away. But that's okay. I like Tommy. He got me in the first big play I ever did. Really, Marvin asks. You've done a lot of theater? Not much, she says. I get bored doing the same shit again and again. So, Paul Wankos is your favorite director, huh? Marvin asks. Yeah, I started out with him in my early days. I'm in his Cliff Robertson picture, Battle of the Coral Sea. You can see me and Tommy Laughlin hanging out in the back of the submarine the whole damn picture. Marvin makes one of his declarative industry statements. Paul fucking Wankos, underrated action specialist. Very true, Rick agrees. And when I landed Bounty Law, he came on and directed about 7 or 8 episodes. So, Rick asks, fishing for a compliment. I hope the Rick Dalton double feature wasn't too painful for you and the missus. Marvin laughs. Painful, stop, wonderful, 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 Marvin continues. So Mary Alice and I watch Tanner. Mary Alice doesn't like the violence in modern movies these days, so I saved McCluskey to watch by myself after she went to bed. Then there's a small tap on the office door. Just before the miniskirt-wearing Miss Himmelstein enters the office, carrying 2 cups of steaming coffee for Rick and Marvin, she carefully hands the hot beverages to the 2 gentlemen. This is from Rex's office, right? Rex said you owe him one of your cigars. The agent snorts. That cheap Jew bastard. The only thing I owe him is a hard time. Everybody laughs. Thank you, Miss Himmelstein. That will be all for now. She exits, leaving the 2 men alone to discuss the entertainment business, Rick Dalton's career, and, more important, his future. Where was I? Marvin asks. Oh, yeah. Violence in modern movies. Mary Alice doesn't like it, but she loves westerns. Always has. We saw westerns all through our courtship. Watching westerns together is one of our favorite things to do. And we thoroughly enjoyed Tanner. Ah, that's nice, Rick says. Now, when we do these double features, Marvin explains, by the last 3 reels of the first film, Mary Alice is asleep in my lap. But for Tanner, she made it to just before the last reel, which was 9:30, which is pretty good for Mary Alice. As Marvin explains to Rick the movie-viewing habits of the happy couple, Rick takes a sip of the hot coffee. Hey, that's good, the actor thinks. This Rex fella does have classy coffee. Marvin continues. Movie's over, she goes to bed, I open up a box of Havanas, pour myself a cognac, and watch the second movie by myself. Rick takes another sip of Rex's delicious coffee. Marvin points at the coffee cup. Good stuff, huh? What? Rick asks. The coffee? No, the pastrami, of course the coffee, Marvin says with Catskill timing. It's fucking sensational, Rick agrees. Where does he get it? One of those delicatessens here in Beverly Hills, but he won't say which one, Marvin says, then continues with Mary Alice's viewing habits. This morning after breakfast, and after I leave for the office, the projectionist, Greg, comes back and screens the last reel so she can see how the picture ends. And that's our movie watching routine. We're very happy about it. And she was very much looking forward to seeing how Tanner ends. Then Marvin adds, however, she'd already figured out you're gonna have to kill your father, Ralph Meeker, before it's all over. Well, Yeah. That's the problem with the movie, Rick says. It ain't if I kill the domineering patriarch, it's when. And it ain't if Michael Callan, the sensitive brother, kills me, it's when. Marvin agrees. True. But both of us thought you and Ralph Mika matched up pretty well together. Yeah, me too, Rick replies. We did make a good father and son team. That fucking Michael Callan looked like he was adopted. But with me, you could believe Ralph was my old man. Well, the reason you matched up so well together was you two shared a similar dialect. Rick laughs, especially when compared to fucking Michael Callan, who sounded like he should be surfing in Malibu. Okay, Marvin thinks. That's the second time Rick has put down his Tanner co-star Michael Callan. That's not a good sign. It suggests stinginess in spirit. It suggests a blamer. But Marvin keeps these thoughts to himself. I thought Ralph Meeker was sensational, Rick tells the agent. The best damn actor I ever worked with, and I've worked with Edward G. Robinson. He was also in two of the best bounty laws. Marvin continues recounting his Rick Dalton double feature from the night before, which brings us to the 14 Fists of McCluskey. What a picture. So much fun. He pantomimes shooting a machine gun. All the shooting, all the killing, Marvin asks. How many Nazi bastards you kill in that picture? 100? 150? Rick laughs. I never counted, but 150? It sounds right. Marvin curses them to himself. Fucking Nazi bastards. That's you operating the flamethrower, ain't it? You bet your sweet ass it is, Rick says. And that's one shit-fuck crazy weapon you do not want to be on the wrong side of. Boy, oh boy, let me tell you. I practiced with that dragon 3 hours a day for 2 weeks. Not just so I'd look good in the picture, but because I was shit scared of the damn thing, to tell you the truth. Extraordinary, says the impressed agent. You know, it was just sheer luck I got my role, Rick tells Marvin. Originally, Fabian had my part. Then 8 days before shooting, he breaks his shoulder doing a Virginian. Mr. Wencoast remembered me, talked the brass over at Columbia into getting Universal to loan me out to do McCluskey. Rick concludes the story the way he always does. So I do 5 movies during my contract with Universal. My most successful film, my Columbia loan out. Marvin removes a gold cigarette case from his inside jacket pocket, pops it open with a ping, offers one to Rick. Care for, Kent? Rick takes one. Do you like the cigarette case? It's very nice. It's a gift from Joseph Cotton, one of my most cherished clients. Rick gives Marvin the impressed expression the agent is demanding. I recently got him both a Sergio Corbucci picture and an Ishiro Honda picture, and this was a token of his gratitude. Those names mean nothing to Rick. As Mr. Schwarz slips the gold cigarette case back in the inside pocket of his jacket, Rick quickly digs his cigarette lighter out of his pants pocket, snaps open the lid of the silver Zippo, and lights both smokes in his cool guy way. When he's done lighting both cigarettes, he snaps the lid of the Zippo closed with loud panache. Marvin chuckles at the show of bravado, then inhales the nicotine. What do you smoke? Marvin asks Rick. Capital W lights, Rick says, but also Chesterfields, Red Apples. And don't laugh, Virginia Slims. Marvin laughs anyway. Hey, I like the taste, is Rick's defense. I'm laughing at you smoking Red Apples, Marvin explains. That cigarette is a sin against nicotine. They were the sponsor of Bounty Law, so I got used to them. Also, I thought it was smart to be seen smoking them in public. Very wise, Marvin says. Now, Rick, Sid's your regular agent, and he asked me, would I meet you? Rick nods his head. Do you know why he asked me to get together with you? To see if you wanted to work with me, Rick answers. Marvin laughs. Well, ultimately, yes. But what I'm getting at is, do you know what I do here at William Morris? Yeah, Rick says, you're an agent. Yeah, but you already got Sid as your agent. If I was just an agent, you wouldn't be here, Marvin says. Yeah, you're a special agent, Rick says. Indeed I am, Marvin says. Then, pointing at Rick with his smoking cigarette, but I want you to tell me what it is you think I do. Well, Rick says, the way it was explained to me is you put famous American talent in foreign films. Not bad, Marvin says. Now that the two gentlemen are on the same page, both take big drags off their Kents. Marvin exhales a long stream of cigarette smoke and goes into his spiel. Now, Rick, if we get to know one another, one of the first things about me you'll learn is nothing, and I mean nothing, is as important to me as my client list. The reason I have the contacts I have in the Italian film industry and the German film industry and the Japanese film industry and the Filipino film industry is both because of the clients I represent and what my client list represents. Unlike others, I am not in the has-been business. I am in the Hollywood royalty business. Van Johnson, Joseph Cotton, Folly Granger, Russ Tamblyn, Mel Ferrer. The agent says each name as if he's reciting the names of the faces carved on Hollywood's Mount Rushmore. Hollywood royalty with a filmography peppered with all-time classics. The agent gives a legendary example. When a drunk Lee Marvin dropped out of the role of Colonel Mortimer in For a Few Dollars More, 3 weeks before filming, it was me who got Sergio Leone to take his fat ass to the Sportsman's Lodge and have coffee with a newly clean and sober Lee Van Cleef. The agent lets the magnitude of that story settle in the room. Then, taking a nonchalant drag off his Kent, he blows out the smoke and adds another one of his declarative industry statements. And the rest, as they say, is New World Western mythology. Marvin zeroes in on the cowboy actor across the glass table. Now, Rick, Bounty Law was a good show, and you were good on it. A lot of folks come to town and get famous for doing shit. Ask Gardner McKay. Rick laughs at the Gardner McKay dig. Marvin continues, but Bounty Law was a totally decent cowboy show. And you have that, and you can be proud of that. But now, on to the future. But before the future, let's get a little history straight. As the two men smoke cigarettes, Marvin begins quizzing Rick as if he's either on a game show or being interrogated by the FBI. So, Bounty Law. That was NBC, right? Yep, NBC. How long? How long what? How long was the show? Well, it was a half-hour show, so 23 minutes with commercials. And how long did it last? We started in the fall schedule of the 59-60 television season. And when did you go off the air? The middle of the 63-64 season. Did you ever go to color? Didn't make color. How'd you get the show? You come in off the street? Or did the network groom you? I'd guessed it on Tales of Wells Fargo. I played Jesse James. So that's what got their attention? Yes, I still had to screen test. And I had better be fucking good, but yes. Go through the details of the movies you did during your hiatus. Well, the first one, Rick says, was Comanche Uprising, starring a very old, very ugly Robert Taylor. But that became a theme in almost all my motion pictures, Rick explains. Old guy paired with a young guy. Me and Robert Taylor. Me and Stuart Granger. Me and Glenn Ford. There was never just me on my own, says the actor frustrated. It was always me and some old fuck. Marvin asks, who directed Comanche Uprising? Bud Springsteen. Marvin makes an observation. I noticed on your resume you worked with a hell of a lot of those old Republic Pictures cowboy directors. Springsteen, William Whitney, Harmon Jones, John English. Rick laughs. The get it done guys. Then he clarifies. But Bud Springsteen wasn't just a get it done guy. Bud didn't just get it done. Bud was different than those others. That interests Marvin. What was the difference? Huh? Rick asks. Bud and the other get it done guys, Marvin asks. What was the difference? Rick doesn't have to think about his answer because he figured this out years ago when guesting on Whirly Birds with Craig Hill, helmed by Bud. Bud had the same amount of time as all the rest of those goddamn directors, Rick says with authority. Not one day, not one hour, not one sunset more than anybody else. But it was what he did with that time that made Bud good, Rick says sincerely. You were proud to work for Bud. Marvin likes that. And goddamn Wild Bill Whitney gave me my start, Rick says. He gave me my first real part. You know, a character with a name. Then he gave me my first lead. What film? Marvin asks. Oh, just one of those juvenile delinquent hot rod flicks for Republic, Rick says. Marvin asks, what was the title? Drag Race No Stop, says Rick. And I did a goddamn Ron Ely Tarzan for him just this last year. Marvin laughs. So you two go back a long way. Me and Bill, Rick says, you bet. Rick's getting into his reminiscing, and it's going over well, too, so he leans into it. Let me tell you about goddamn Bill Whitney, the single most underrated action director in this goddamn town. Bill Whitney didn't just direct action, he invented directing action. You said you like westerns. You know that whole Yakima Canutt action gag where he jumps from horse to horse, then falls and goes under the hooves in John Ford's fucking stagecoach? Marvin nods his head, yes. William fucking Whitney did it fucking first, and did it 1 year before John Ford with Yakima Canutt. I didn't know that, Marvin says. What picture? He hadn't even made a feature yet. Rick tells him. He did that gag for some fucking cereal. Let me tell you what it is like being directed by William Whitney. Bill Whitney works under the assumption that there was no scene ever written that couldn't be improved by the addition of a fistfight. Marvin laughs. Rick continues. So I'm doing a riverboat with Bill directing. Me and Burt Reynolds in the scene. So me and Burt are doing the scene, saying the dialogue. Then Bill goes, cut, cut, cut. You guys are putting me to sleep. Bert, when he says that to you, you punch him. And Rick, when he punches you, that makes you mad. So you punch him back. Got it? Okay, action. And so we do it. And when we get done, he yells, cut, that's it, boys. Now we got a scene. The two men laugh inside the cloud of cigarette smoke that's filling up the office. Marvin's starting to warm up to Rick's sense of hard-earned Hollywood experience. So tell me about this Stuart Granger film you mentioned, Marvin asks. Big game, Rick says. An African great white hunter piece of crap. They were walking out of it on airplanes. Marvin guffaws. Rick informs the agent. Stuart Granger was the single biggest prick I ever worked with, and I worked with Jack Lord. After the two men chuckle over the Jack Lord dig, Marvin asks the actor, and you did a picture with George Cukor? Yeah, Rick says. A real dog called the Chapman Report. Brake director, terrible picture. The agent asks, how did you get along with Q-Corp? Are you kidding? Rick asks. George fucking loved me. Then he leans a bit over the coffee table and says insinuatingly in a lower voice, I mean, really loved me. The agent smiles, letting the actor know he gets the insinuation. I think that's a thing George does, Rick speculates. He picks a boy on each movie to go gaga over. And on that picture, it was between me and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. So, I guess I won. He goes on to illustrate. So in that picture, all my scenes are with Glynis Johns. And we go to a pool. So Glynis is in a one-piece swimsuit. All you can see is legs and arms, everything else covered up. But me, I'm in the teeny tiniest pair of swim trunks the sensors will allow. Tan swim trunks. On black and white film, looks like I'm fucking naked. And it's not just a shot of me jumping in the pool. I'm in these tiny trunks doing big dialogue scenes with my ass hanging out for 10 minutes of the fucking movie. I mean, what the fuck? Am I Betty Grable over here? Again, the two men laugh as Marvin removes a small leather notebook from the opposite inside jacket pocket of the one containing Joseph Cotton's gold cigarette case. I had a few of my satellites look up your statistics in Europe, and as they say, so far, so good. Searching for the notes in the little book, he asks out loud, did bounty law air in Europe? Finds the page he's looking for, then looks from the page to Rick. Yes, it did. Good. Rick smiles. Marvin looks back down at the book and says, where? Searching the page and finding the data he's looking for. Italy. Good. England. Good. Germany. Good. No France. But then he looks up at Rick and says as consolation, but... yes, Belgium. So they know who you are in Italy, England, Germany, and Belgium. Marvin concludes. So that's your TV show. But you've done a few flicks. So, how did they do? Marvin looks back down at the little book in his hands, flipping through the little pages, searching its contents. Actually, finding what he's looking for. All three of your westerns, Comanche Uprising, Hellfire, Texas, and Tana, did relatively well in Italy, France, and Germany. Looking back up to Rick, with Tana doing even better than that in France. Can you read French? Marvin asks Rick. No, Rick answers. Too bad, Marvin says as he removes a folded up Xerox page stuck in the little notebook and hands it across the coffee table to Rick. This is the Cahiers de Cinema review of Tana. It's a good review. Very well written. You should get it translated. Rick takes the Xerox from Marvin, nodding at the agent's suggestion, though the actor knows full well he'll never do that. But then Marvin raises his head to meet Rick's eyes and says, suddenly enthusiastic, but the best news in this whole fucking book, the 14 Fists of McCluskey. Rick's face lights up as Marvin continues. Now, in America, that did okay for Columbia when it was released. But in Europe, fuck me. He lowers his head to read the information in front of him. Says here, the 14 Fists of McCluskey was a fucking smash all over Europe. Played everywhere and played for fucking ever. Marvin looks up, closes his little book and concludes. So in Europe, they know who you are. They know your TV show. But even more than the guy from Bounty Law. In Europe, you're the cool guy with the eye patch and the flamethrower that kills 150 Nazis in the 14 Fists of McCluskey. After making that huge statement, Marvin grinds his Kent out in the ashtray. What was your last theatrical feature? Now it's Rick's turn to grind out his cigarette in the ashtray as he grunts. A horrible children's movie, made for the kiddie matinee crowd, called Salty the Talkin' Sea Otter. Marvin smiles. Take it you're not the title character. Rick smiles grimly at the agent's joke, but nothing about that movie does he find funny. That was the film Universal dumped me in to finish my 4-picture contract, Rick explains, which just goes to show how much Universal gave a fuck about me. I remember that prick Jennings Lang selling me a whole bill of goods, luring me over to Universal with a 4-picture deal. I had Avco Embassy offering me a deal, National General Pictures offering me a deal, Irving Allen Productions offered me a deal. I turned them all down and went with Universal because they were the major. And because Jennings Lang told me, Universal wants to be in the Rick Dalton business. After I signed up, I never saw that prick again. Referring to the time Invasion of the Body Snatchers producer, Walter Wanger, shot Jennings Lang in the groin for fucking his wife, Joan Bennett. If anybody deserved to get their balls shut off, it's that prick, Jennings Lang, adding bitterly, Universal was never in the Rick Dalton business. Rick picks up his coffee cup and takes a sip. It's gone cold. He puts it back down on the table with a sigh. Marvin continues, So for the last 2 years, you've been doing guest shots on episodic TV shows? Rick nods his head in the affirmative. Yeah, I'm doing a pilot for CBS right now, Lancer. I'm the heavy. I did Green Hornet, Land of the Giants, Iran Ely, Tarzan. The one I mentioned I did with William Whitney. I did that show Bingo Martin with that kid Scott Brown. Rick doesn't like Scott Brown, so when he mentions his name, he subconsciously gives a dismissive look. And I just finished an FBI for Quinn Martin. Marvin sips his coffee, even though it's gone a little cool. So you've been doing pretty good. I've been working, Rick says, as if to clarify. Did you play the bad guy in all these shows? Marvin asks. Not Land of the Giants, but the rest, yeah. Did they all end in fight scenes? Again, not Land of the Giants. Or the FBI, but the rest, yeah. Now the $64,000 question, Marvin asks. Did you lose the fight? Of course, Rick says. I'm the heavy. Marvin lets out a big to make his point. That's an old trick pulled by the networks. Take Bingo Martin, for example. So you got a new guy like Scott Brown, and you want to build up his bona fides. So you hire a guy from a canceled show to play the heavy. Then at the end of the show, when they fight, it's hero besting heavy. But then Marvin goes on to explain, but what the audience sees is Bingo Martin whipping the guy from Bounty Law's ass. Ouch, thinks Rick, that fucking smarted. But Marvin's not done. The next week, it's Ron Ely in his loincloth. And the week after that, it's Bob Conrad in his tight pants kicking your ass. Marvin drives his right fist into the palm of his left hand for effect. Another couple of years playing punching bag to every swinging dick new to the network, Marvin explains, is going to have a psychological effect on how the audience perceives you. The masculine humiliation of what Marvin's suggesting, even though he's only referring to play acting, is making Rick's brow perspire. I'm a punching bag. Is this my career now? Losing fights to the season's new swinging dick, is that how Tris Coffin, star of 26 Men, felt when he lost his fight to me on Bounty Law? Or Kent Taylor? While Rick dwells on this, Marvin moves on to another subject. Now I've heard at least 4 people tell me a story about you. Schwarz starts. But none of them know the whole story, so I want you to tell me. Marvin asks, what's this about you almost playing the McQueen role in The Great Escape? Oh, Christ, Not this fucking story again, thinks Rick. Though completely unamused, he laughs it off for Marvin's benefit. It's only a good story for the Sportsman's Lodge crowd, Rick chuckles. You know, the part you almost got. The fish that got away. Those are my favorite stories, the agent says. Tell me. Rick has had to tell this shaggy dog story so much, he's reduced it down to its basic elements. Swallowing his resentment, Rick plays the part that's a little out of his range. A humble actor. Well, Rick begins, apparently at the same time that John Sturges offered McQueen the title role of Hiltz, the Cooler King, in The Great Escape, Carl Foreman, referencing the powerhouse writer-producer of The Guns of Navarone and The Bridge on the River Kwai, was making his directorial debut with a film called The Victors, and he offered McQueen one of the lead roles. And apparently, McQueen vacillated so much, Sturges was forced to draw up a list of possible replacements for the character. And apparently I was on the list. Marvin asks, who else was on the list? Four names on the list, Rick says. Me and the three Georges, Papard, Maharis, and Shakiris. Well, Marvin enthusiastically insists, out of that list, I can totally see you getting it. I mean, if Paul Newman was on the list, maybe not, but the fucking Georges. Well, McQueen did it, Rick shrugs. So what does it matter? No, Marvin insists. It's a good story. We can see you in the role. The Italians will love it. Marvin Schwarz then explains to Rick Dalton how the genre film industry in Italy operates. McQueen won't work with the Italians, no matter what. Fuck the fucking WOPs. That's what Steve says. Tell him to get Bobby Darin. That's what fucking Steve says. He'll work for 9 months in Indochina with Robert Wise, but won't work 2 months at Cinecittà with Guido De Fazio for any amount of money. If I were in Steve's position, I wouldn't waste my time in a shitty WOP Western either, Rick thinks to himself. Marvin continues, Dino De Laurentiis offered to buy him a villa in Florence. Italian producers offered him $500,000 and a new Ferrari for 10 days' work on a Gina Lola Brigida picture. Then Marvin adds, as an aside, not to mention the pretty much for sure Lola Brigida pussy to go along with it. Rick and Marvin laugh. Well, that's a different story, Rick thinks. I'd make any movie ever if I thought I could fuck Anita Ekberg. But, Marvin says, that just makes the Italians want him more. So even though Steve always says no, and Brando always says no, and Warren Beatty always says no, the Italians keep trying. And when they can't get him, they settle. They settle, Rick repeats. Marvin illustrates further. They want Marlon Brando. They get Burt Reynolds. They want Warren Beatty. They get George Hamilton. As Rick endures Marvin's career postmortem, he can feel the burning, stinging sensation of tears starting to build behind his eyeballs. Marvin, oblivious to Rick's anguish, finishes, I'm not saying the Italians don't want you. I'm saying the Italians will want you. But the reason they want you is they want McQueen, but they can't get McQueen. And when they finally realize they're not going to get McQueen, they're gonna want a McQueen they can get. And that's you. The glaring, brutal honesty of the agent's words shock Rick Dalton as much as if Marvin had slapped him across the face as hard as he could with a dripping wet hand. However, from Marvin's perspective, this is all good news. If Rick Dalton was a popular leading man in studio features, he wouldn't be having a meeting with Marvin Schwarz. Besides, it was Rick who asked to meet Marvin. It's Rick who wants to extend his leading man career in feature films rather than playing bad guy du jour on television. and it's Marvin's job to explain to him the realities and the possible opportunities of a film industry he doesn't know shit about. An industry that Marvin is an acknowledged expert in. And in Marvin's expert opinion, Rick Dalton being like one of the biggest movie stars in the whole wide world is a wonderful opportunity for an agent who places name American talent in Italian motion pictures. So he's understandably puzzled when he notices tears running down Rick Dalton's cheeks. "What's the matter, kid?" the startled agent asks. "You crying?" An upset and embarrassed Rick Dalton wipes at his eyes with the back of his hand and says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Schwartz, I apologize." Marvin grabs a box of tissues off his desk and offers it to Rick, consoling the weepy thespian. "Sorry, nothing. We all get upset every once in a while. Life is hard." Rick yanks out two Kleenexes from the box with a harsh ripping sound. As macho as he can muster under the circumstances, he wipes his eyes with the tissue paper. "I'm okay now, just embarrassed. Sorry about this humiliating display." "Display?" Marvin snorts. "What are you talking about? We're human people. Human people cry. It's a good thing." Rick finishes wiping away the wetness and puts a phony smile on his face. "See, all better. Sorry about that." "Sorry about nothing," Marvin admonishes. "You're an actor. Actors have to be able to access their emotions. We need our actors to cry. Sometimes that facility comes at a cost. Now tell me, what's the matter?" Rick composes himself and then says after a gulp of oxygen, "It's just I've been doing this over 10 years, Mr. Schwartz. And it's a little hard to sit here after all that time and come face to face with what a failure I've become. Coming face to face with how I ran my career in the ground." Marvin doesn't understand. "What do you mean, failure?" Rick looks across the coffee table and tells the agent sincerely, "You know, Mr. Schwartz, once upon a time I had potential. I did. You can see it in some of my early work. You can see it on Bounty Law, especially when I had solid guest stars. When it's me and Bronson, and me and Coburn, and me and Meeker, or me and Vic Morrow, I had something. But the studio kept putting me in flicks with faded old fucks. But me and Chuck Heston, that'd been different. Me and Richard Widmark, me and Misham, me and Hank Fonda, that'd been different. And in some of the movies, it's there. Me and Meeker and Tanner. Me and Rod Taylor and McCluskey. Shit, even me and Glenn Ford in Hellfire, Texas. By that time, Ford didn't give a fuck no more, but he still looked strong as hell, and we looked good together. So yeah, I had potential. But whatever potential I had, that prick Jennings Lang at Universal pissed it away." Then the actor exhales a defeated, dramatic breath and says to the floor, "Hell, even I pissed it away." He looks up and meets the eyes of the agent. "I totally pissed away a fourth season of Bounty Law, 'cause I was done with TV. I wanted to be a movie star. I wanted to catch Steve McQueen. If he could do it, I could do it. If during the entire third season, I hadn't been an uncooperative pain in the ass, we would have sailed into a fourth season, and we could have all done well, and all parted friends. Now, Screen Gems hates me. Those goddamn Bounty Law producers are going to hold a grudge against me for the rest of their lives, and I deserve it. I was a prick on that last season. I let everybody goddamn know I had better places to be than this fucking pipsqueak TV show." Rick's starting to get teary-eyed again. "Doing that show, Bingo Martin. I hated that prick Scott Brown. Now, I was never as bad as him. You can ask the actors I worked with. You can ask the directors I worked with. I was never as bad as him. And I've worked with pricks before. But the reason this prick got to me, I saw how ungrateful he was. And when I saw that, I saw myself. He looks at the floor again and says with sincere self-pity, maybe getting the snot wiped out of me by this season's new swinging dick is what I got coming. Marvin listens to the whole explosion that bursts forth from Rick Dalton with his mouth closed and his ears open. After a moment, the agent says, Mr. Dalton, you're not the first young actor to land a series and fall under the spell of hubris. In fact, it's a common ailment out here. And look at me. Rick raises his eyes to the agent's eyes. Marvin finishes. It's forgivable. Then Marvin smiles at the actor. The actor smiles back. But, the agent adds, it does require a bit of reinvention. What do I have to reinvent myself as? Rick asks. Marvin answers, somebody humble. Chapter 2. I Am Curious, Cliff. Rick Dalton, stunt double, 46-year-old Cliff Booth, sits in the waiting room of Marvin Schwarz's office on the third floor of the William Morris Agency building, leafing through an oversized copy of Life magazine that the agent provides those who wait. Cliff wears tight Levi's blue jeans and a matching Levi's blue jeans jacket over a black t-shirt. This outfit is a leftover costume from a low-budget biker flick that Cliff worked on 3 years earlier. Actor-director Tom Laughlin, an old buddy of Rick's and a friend of Cliff's, they all did the 14 Fists of McCluskey together, had hired Cliff to stunt double a couple of biker characters in a motorcycle movie he was starring in and directing, The Born Losers, for American International Pictures. It would end up being AIP's biggest hit of the year. In the film, Laughlin would play, for the first time, the character that would make him one of the most popular pop culture movie characters of the 70s, Billy Jack. Billy Jack was a half-breed American Indian Vietnam veteran Hapkido expert who didn't mind demonstrating it on the violent biker gang known in the movie as the Born Losers, the stand-in for the Hells Angels. Cliff's job was to double one of the gang members, known as Gang Green, played by David Carradine's old buddy Jeff Cooper, who Cliff kind of looked like. However, during the last week of the shoot, Tom's stunt double dislocated his elbow, not performing a gag but skateboarding on his day off. So Cliff filled in doubling for Tom that whole last week of the shoot. At the end of the shoestring production, when given a choice between $75 or keeping the Billy Jack wardrobe, leather boots included, Cliff opted for the outfit. 4 years later, Tom Laughlin would star in and direct the movie Billy Jack for Warner Brothers. Laughlin would be disappointed by how the studio marketed the picture. He would buy back the rights himself, then sell it state by state, market by market, like an old carny promoter. Laughlin four-walled movie theaters and flooded the local TV stations with enticingly cut TV spots aimed at kids watching television in the afternoon after school. Laughlin's maverick distribution innovations, along with his having made a pretty terrific movie, made Billy Jack one of the biggest sleeper success stories in the history of Hollywood. And once that happened, Cliff's blue jeans wardrobe became so identified with the high-kicking hero that he had to stop wearing it. While Miss Himmelstein sits behind her desk in the outer office answering the telephone, Mr. Schwarz's office? Pause. I'm sorry, he's with a client right now. Can I ask who's calling? Cliff sits on a colorful, uncomfortable couch by her desk, huge Life magazine laid out on his lap, leafing through the pages. He's just finished reading Richard Schickel's review of the new Swedish film that has all of America's Puritans and many of their newspaper-based opinion makers in a tizzy. This new movie has both Johnny Carson and Joey Bishop, as well as every comedian from Jerry Lewis to Moms Mabley, making puns out of its catchy title. From the couch, Cliff calls to Miss Himmelstein behind her desk. Have you heard of this flick from Sweden? I am curious, Yellow?
Yeah, I think I have, Miss Himmelstein says. It's supposed to be dirty, isn't it?
Not according to the U.S. Court of Appeals, it ain't, Cliff informs her. Reading directly from the magazine, Cliff recites, pornography is a work lacking in redeeming social value, and according to Judge Paul R. Hayes, whether or not we ourselves consider the ideas of the picture particularly interesting or the production artistically successful, it is quite certain that I Am Curious does present ideas and does strive to present these ideas artistically. He lowers the huge magazine and meets eyes with the pigtailed young thing sitting behind her desk. Miss Himmelstein asks, what does that mean exactly? Exactly. Cliff repeats. It means a Swedish guy who made it wasn't just making a fuck film. He was trying to make art. And it doesn't matter if you think he was a total failure. And it doesn't matter if you think it's the biggest piece of shit you've ever seen in your life. What matters is that he tried to make art. He didn't try and make smut. Then smiling and shrugging his shoulders. At least that's what I get out of this review.
Sounds provocative, the young pigtailed last remarks.
I agree, Cliff agrees. Want to go see it with me?
A sarcastic smirk spreads across Miss Himmelstein's face as she asks with just the right touch of Jewish comic timing, you want to take me to a dirty movie?
No, Cliff corrects. According to Judge Paul something Hayes, I just want to take you to a Swedish film. Where do you live?
Before she can stop herself, she instinctively answers, Brentwood.
Well, I'm pretty familiar with the cinemas around the Los Angeles area, Cliff informs her. Will you allow me to choose the theater?
Janet Himmelstein is well aware she hasn't even agreed to go on a date with Cliff yet. But both she and Cliff know she's going to say yes. Now, William Morris has a rule against miniskirt-wearing secretaries dating their clients, but this guy ain't a client. Rick Dalton's a client. This guy is just one of Rick's buddies. You choose, says the young lady.
Wise choice, says the older man.
They both share a laugh as Marvin's office door swings open and Rick Dalton in his tan leather jacket emerges from the agent's office. Cliff quickly stands up from Marvin's uncomfortable couch and throws his eyes toward his boss to read the demeanor of the meeting he just completed. And since Rick looks a little sweaty and a little distraught, Cliff figures the meeting didn't go so hot.
You okay? Cliff softly asks.
Yeah, I'm fine, Rick says briskly. Let's just get out of here.
Sure thing, Cliff says.
Then the stuntman Cliff spins on his back heel till he's facing Janet Himmelstein, his movement so quick it startles her. She doesn't make a noise, but she does instinctively flinch. Now that Cliff is standing directly in front of her, over her actually, smiling like a blonde Levi-clad Huck Finn, Miss Himmelstein sees how truly handsome this guy really is.
Opens this Wednesday, Cliff informs the young lady. When do you want to go?
Now that he's fully engaging her, goose pimples break out all over the fatty part of her arms. Under the desk, her sandaled right foot rises off the ground and runs down the back of her bare left calf. How about Saturday night? She asks.
How about Sunday afternoon? Cliff negotiates. I'll take you to Baskin-Robbins afterward.
That reaches beyond the Himmelstein giggle to her actual laugh. The woman has a lovely actual laugh. He tells her so, and discovers she has a lovely actual blush. He reaches down and plucks out one of her business cards sitting in what looks like a clear plastic bus stop for business cards, and brings it up to his eyes to read. Janet Himmelstein, he reads out loud. That's me, she giggles self-consciously. The stuntman removes his brown leather wallet from the back pocket of his blue jeans,
opens it up, and makes a show of sliding the white William Morris business card inside. Then the blonde fella starts walking down the hall backward to catch up with his boss. But he still continues his comedic patter with the young secretary. "Now remember, if your mother asks, I'm not taking you to see a dirty movie. I'm taking you to see a foreign film. With subtitles." He gives her a wave just before he disappears around the corner and says, "I'll call you next Friday." When Cliff and Miss Himmelstein saw I Am Curious Yellow at the Royal Cinema in West LA that Sunday afternoon, they both liked it. When it came to cinema, Cliff is far more adventurous than his boss. To Rick, movies are what Hollywood made. And with the exception of England, all other countries' film industries are simply the best they can do, since they're not Hollywood. But after all the blood and violence Cliff experienced during World War II, once Cliff returned home, he was surprised at how juvenile he found most Hollywood movies. There were some exceptions. The Oxbow Incident, Body and Soul, White Heat, The Third Man, The Brothers Rico, Riot in Cell Block 11, but they were irregularities in a fake normalcy. After the devastation that the countries of Europe and Asia experienced during the Second World War, once those countries slowly started making movies again, oftentimes surrounded by the bombed-out rubble remnants of the war, Rome, Open City, Big Deal on Madonna Street, they discovered they were making them for a far more adult audience. While in America, and when I say America, I mean Hollywood, a country where its home front civilians were shielded from the gruesome details of the conflict, their movies remained stubbornly immature and frustratingly committed to the concept of entertainment for the whole family. To Cliff, who had borne witness to the stark extremities of humanity, like the heads of his Filipino guerrilla brothers stuck on spikes by the occupying Japanese, even the most entertaining actors of his era, Brando, Paul Newman, Ralph Meeker, John Garfield, Robert Mitchum, George C. Scott, always sounded like actors and reacted to events the way only characters in movies did. There was always a level of artifice to the character that stopped it from being convincing. After he got back to the States, Cliff's favorite Hollywood actor was Alan Ladd. He liked the way the diminutive lad would practically swim in the modern 40s and 50s fashions he wore. He didn't care for him in westerns or war films. He disappeared in cowboy attire and military uniforms. Ladd needed to be in a suit and tie and preferably a snap-brim fedora. Cliff liked his look. He was handsome without being movie star handsome. Since Cliff was so damn handsome, he appreciated other men who weren't, but didn't need to be. Alan Ladd looked like a few guys he served with. He also liked that Ladd looked like an American, but he loved the way the little guy fought fistfights in his movies. He loved how he socked the shit out of the character actors who specialized in playing gangsters. He loved that droopy lock of hair that hung in his face during the fight. And he loved how Ladd used to roll around on the floor with the heavies. But his absolute favorite thing about Ladd? His voice. He had a no-nonsense way of delivering his lines. When Ladd acted opposite William Bendix, Robert Preston, Brian Donlevy, or Ernest Borgnine, they all seemed like ham-bone actors when compared to him. When Ladd got mad in a movie, he didn't act mad. He just got sore, like a real fella. As far as Cliff was concerned, Alan Ladd was the only guy in movies who knew how to comb his hair, wear a hat, or smoke a cigarette. Okay, Mitchum knew how to smoke a cigarette, too. But that just goes to show how unrealistic Cliff found Hollywood films. When he saw Otto Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder, he laughed at what the newspapers referred to as the film's shockingly adult language. He joked with Rick, "Only in a Hollywood movie would spermicide be considered shockingly adult." However, when he saw foreign movies, the actors had a level of authenticity that just wasn't there in Hollywood movies. Hands down, no question about it, Cliff's favorite actor was Toshirô Mifune. He'd get so into watching Methuni's face he'd sometimes forget to read the subtitles. The other foreign actor Cliff dug was Jean-Paul Belmondo. When Cliff saw Belmondo in Breathless, he thought, that guy looks like a fucking monkey. But a monkey I like. Like Paul Newman, who Cliff liked, Belmondo had movie star charm. But when Paul Newman played a bastard, like in Hud, he was still an enjoyable bastard. But the guy in Breathless wasn't just a sexy stud prick. He was a little creep, petty thief piece of shit. And unlike in a Hollywood movie, they didn't sentimentalize him. They always sentimentalize these pieces of shit in Hollywood movies, and it was the phoniest thing Hollywood did. In the real world, these mercenary fuckfaces didn't have a sentimental bone in their body. That's why Cliff appreciated Belmondo not doing that with his little shit heel and Breathless. Foreign films, Cliff thought, were more like novels. They didn't care if you liked the lead characters or not. And Cliff found that intriguing. So, starting in the 50s, Cliff started driving to Beverly Hills and Santa Monica and West Los Angeles and Little Tokyo to see black and white foreign films with English subtitles. La Strada, Yojimbo, Ikiru, The Bridge, Rififi, Bicycle Thieves, Rocco and His Brothers, Open City, Seven Samurai, Lidulos, Bitter Rice, which Cliff thought was sexy as hell. I don't go to movies to read, Rick would tease Cliff about his cinephilia. Cliff would just smile at his boss's teasing, but he always felt proud of himself for reading subtitles. He felt smarter. He liked expanding his mind. He liked the task of grappling with difficult concepts that didn't present themselves at first. After the first 20 minutes, there was nothing more to learn about a new Rock Hudson or Kirk Douglas movie. But these foreign movies, sometimes you had to watch the whole movie just to know what it was you saw. But he wasn't buffaloed by them either. They still, one way or another, had to work as a movie. Or what was the point? Cliff didn't know enough to write critical pieces for films and review. But he knew enough to know Hiroshima Mona Moore was a piece of crap. He knew enough to know that Antonioni was a fraud. He also liked looking at events from different perspectives. Ballad of a Soldier gave him respect for his Soviet allies that he never had before. Kunal taught him maybe his wartime experience, compared to some, wasn't so bad. Bernhard Vicky's The Bridge made him do something he thought was impossible, cry for Germans. He usually didn't share these Sunday afternoons with anybody. Sunday afternoon was his foreign film day. Nobody else in his circle was interested. It was almost comical how little the stunt community cared about film itself. But Cliff even liked going to these movies by himself. This was his private time with Mifune, Belmondo, Bob the Gambler, Jean Gabin, both handsome Gabin and shock white Gabin. This was his time with Akira Kurosawa.